This is an example of speech.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge. Thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard evergreen topical heatwave of an ongoing conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment section in our minds. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. To listen to the archives, go to stoneduckmedia.com or tellmewhattothink.com. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis, and I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at green_weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we tell you what to think about arms control. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think.
Washing guns and drugs, financing the lives of the classless thugs, fighting over against the sell cocaine, ingesting
conscious
part of the insane propagation of the old boys network decision signed
with exactly the shaken grandstanding, but she was
those who benefit never ask
not exactly addressing the Mueller report. Which, by the way, still makes it better than the what the Republicans are doing, which is addressing Hillary Clinton. But by the way, I am recording. She was asking for Bill Barr's support in passing these pieces of legislation she's put together, which actually probably are good pieces of legislation, but kind of like election security. Like, if you receive federal money, which I assume most state election systems and local ones do, but if you receive federal money, you're subject to audits by the federal government. And it might have a paper ballot thing in it. I don't think she mentioned that just now, but I recall hearing about the act before.
It is totally grandstanding asking, like, Trump's AG to support something that she wrote.
How do you define grandstanding? I just assume there's like a theatrical element to it.
Like a congressional hearing?
Well, I mean, like what? Let me look up grandstanding. What is grandstanding? Seek to attract applause or favorable attention from spectators or the media. Okay, yeah, it's grandstanding.
Yeah.
Because maybe not the like applause, like, in the moment thing, like, get people riled up, but she's definitely looking for that, like, she's the reasonable bipartisan Democrat.
Yeah. There's no process function to her line of questioning. Not even an oversight role.
Well, you know what, I'd say it's almost a little bit process, which is, she's like, hey, I put this thing together. We had all this bipartisan support. It's just like the reasonable thing to do. Like, this is our job. We should be doing things like this, responding to problems with legislation. And she's like, but just as we are about to get it passed, or at least brought up on a vote, the Trump White House started calling around and got it shut down. So kind of revealing a little bit of that, I think, is it's not a bad venue to do it in.
No, it's probably the only venue she really has.
Yeah, it's not like she can get a goddamn decent interview or anything. I mean, I'd take that back. She is on, like, Meet the Press and stuff a lot, but not really so much as, like, a candidate. Not that that's my concern, but...
Yeah, I'm surprised nobody's dropped out yet to update the field. Has anybody announced...
Well, Biden, I think, since we last...
Oh, right. But he's been on all the opinion polls, so...
Yeah. Yeah, and comically, in our 2020 Roundup episode, in which we declared we wouldn't talk about him, I kept bringing him up. So we talked about him pretty thoroughly.
We've gone over his record pretty thoroughly, yeah.
I mean, he definitely got more attention in that episode than, like, I don't know, Cory Booker did, or...
Yeah, any of the other individuals...
By the way, if Cory Booker becomes president, which he won't, but if he does, that guy who used to be on Key and Peele, not Jordan Peele, but the other guy, Key, I don't know his full name.
Mm-hmm.
That guy looks a lot like Cory Booker. Like, he will make a fortune if he gets a decent impression down, which he even sounds like Cory Booker a little bit.
Well, he's probably also from New Jersey, so.
Yeah, he might be. anyway, so we were going to... Well, oh, hey, before we talk about that, you want to talk about... you wanted to bring up...
Venezuela?
No, Jacob Green.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Jacob Green. He's dropping a new album. I don't think it's dropped yet, so I won't give away the name of it or anything. I think it's in production.
Keep an eye out for it, though. He was on our podcast a year ago, sort of talk about being a musician.
Yeah, he's done a bunch of shows out east. If you're ever in Vermont and the New Hampshire area, look. You should look at his website on Friday because he's probably playing somewhere.
There's definitely someone listening to this podcast that is going to go to that area of the country on, like, a summer vacation or something. I want to go to Vermont on a summer vacation.
Yeah, so do I. I've never been that far east.
Yeah. I've been to New York, but I haven't touched the, New England area.
Yeah, going to New York City by itself is kind of like going to an ancient city-state that is, like, almost in its own particular vacuum.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even get off Manhattan except to go to the airport.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in Brooklyn. I mean, technically we stayed in Brooklyn, but we did everything. in Manhattan. All right, so yeah, people, check out Jacob Green, friend of the podcast for sure. So, we are talking today about a very complicated thing. Getting into, like, the Code of Federal Regulation change. So, how would you summarize this?
So, in the later years of the Bush administration, in about 2006, 2007, it was obvious to the world that we needed to move in a direction of controlling international transfers of small arms. Because in too many places, they'd fallen through official and unofficial cracks and ended up in the worst hands. And sometimes those were official hands. And, you know, the regulations had to encompass that, too. So in 2013, they turned into the Arms Trade Treaty, which went into effect in 2014, the end of September 2014. It prevents, notionally, the transfer of weapons to conflict zones in accordance with UN embargoes and other humanitarian standards.
Yeah.
But doesn't limit, like, private individual weapons for individual use or... it's not exactly enforced the widest because, for instance, the United States and China don't participate in it, so there's, like, two of the three biggest export or countries that export weapons aren't involved.
Russia, too, right?
Oh, and Russia, sorry. All yeah, three of the biggest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was an okay system. It's kind of kept weapons out of Africa, which is why since then you've kind of seen certain countries, shall we say, move into the American sphere, especially in Africa and the Middle East, because we are not involved in that treaty and we're still transferring weapons to, for instance, Cameroon, which is ruthlessly putting down internal civil war along English and French-speaking lines. So, yeah, in response, as a counterpart to that, President Obama recognized that it is a problem, and we, as the biggest exporter, needed to do something, so he introduced the International Trade in Arms Regulations, the ITAR program, which covers defense, commerce, and state, and is supposed to being like supposed to be a unifying regime of regulations designed to prevent the United States from exporting weapons to the worst places in the world.
Yeah.
And so President Trump last weekend at the NRA, I guess we'll call it a powwow instead of a clusterfuck. No, we can't call it a powwow. That's offensive. What do you call a nest of vipers cavorting?
Board of directors.
Hmm. Okay, so, well, anyways, the NRA is doing whatever you want to call it. The president resigned, whose name currently escapes me, even though I...
Oh, Oliver North?
Yeah, Oliver North resigned. And
well, he said he's... Did he straight up resign or say he's not seeking a re-election? Or was that the re-election?
I think what it was is that he said that the first day and then the next day he resigned.
Oh, okay. I wasn't totally up to date on NRA Twitter, I guess.
Yeah, I don't really follow it very closely, except to know that Oliver North's career is tumbling apart because I don't understand how he had that job to begin with, but that's a whole other episode. Anyway,
It is, but let's just say Oliver North has made a career out of surpassing the expectations of someone who's so fucked up in their previous career.
Right? How could someone with, like, so little moral value and, like, such clear, shall we say, problems in his lines of thought get a position on the National Security Council in the first place as a lieutenant colonel? But anyway,
yeah.
Again, that's a whole other episode.
Which Bill Barr would also be a part of eventually. Because wasn't Barr part of...
He was in Reagan's White House, wasn't he? Then he moved to AG under Bush.
Yeah, and AG under Bush is when a lot of this stuff got cleaned up. The Iran-Contra and all that. I'm not saying it directly ties to Ollie North's story. I don't know enough offhand. But yeah, it's at least in the context surrounding Oliver North's story.
Yeah, there was no accountability. Just tears for the dead.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Trump at the NRA convention announces that he is going through the political flourish of unsigning that treaty, the 2013 Arms Trade Treaty. Hmm. And it's as political flourishes go, or it's has less meaning than most of his. Like even his national emergency at the border has more effect than this. In practical terms, because the United States had signed it, but would, of course, never ratify it, because the United States would never accept any international regulation over weapons, our ability to sell them, produce them, or, you know, use them.
Can we pause here for a second? So, I was having a little trouble when we were first discussing this, understanding this idea of a president sort of unilaterally accepting the treaty and what that all means. And so the executive branch, Obama, is part of the negotiation and signing and whatever. And then for the U.S. to be bound by it, it has to be, according to our law, ratified by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But Obama, through executive administrative rule, like being the boss, can make the departments, or can put in regulation for the departments to...
Like implement the treaty without ratification.
Basically. Yes. But then that leaves open the door then for future presidents to...
Undo it.
Just undo it. Okay.
Which is what happened.
Yep.
But unfortunately there's other... Like, he was also talking about moving what the Department of State does, for instance, into the Department of Commerce, which is... illegal in other ways because the Senate or the Congress has passed other laws like the Leahy bill to prevent arms transfers to particularly egregious factions, especially governments and organizations that commit human rights abuses like the BIST in Cameroon.
So why would Commerce not be bound by that still?
Oh, well, I was just saying they want to move from two Commerce from state because it's the worst possible thing that they could do. Because state's role in this is unique because it's the only part of our government, even more than our national like security and intelligence organizations, that has the languages and the relationships with, you know, everywhere we have an embassy that would provide us the insight to know whether or not these organizations are, you know, not the best recipients for our weapons.
So
they don't comply with the Leahy Amendment.
Yeah, so if Commerce is
if Commerce
even trying to comply, They would either have to just resort to, like, Google searches, which is so Trumpian, or just get the information from state.
Or they would just pencil whip it, which is more likely. I mean, they could do that Google search, or, like, say they did that Google search, and sign it, and then move on, which is absolutely terrible.
But
literally the worst possible outcome.
But Commerce doesn't have agents and the infrastructure,
wherewithal, institutional knowledge
to know about, you know, some sort of guerrilla faction in wherever such and such place,
or to know that, like, you know, this certain organization and, like, a certain Asian army makes the habit of, like, cutting the hands off of its opponents, or you know, summarily executing prisoners. I guess that's in Africa, too, to point at Haftar.
Yeah. And so this is part of the... This is the end result of the export control reform initiative, as far as I understand.
Yes.
Except that was supposed to be... Which I think we would still have quibbles with some of that, which was begun under Obama, but kind of underneath this umbrella of trying to administrate this treaty that's not ratified.
Yeah.
But
implement.
This has sort of been maybe like Trump's going much further than that and just undoing the whole initiative, even beyond just these sort of mundane reforms. He's going all in on.
Yeah, and he's actually innovating, well, I guess if you want to call it that, but he's making a new initiative and taking it from state to commerce.
Yeah.
Which is something that nobody's ever done before for very good reasons. Like, you don't fucking give the salesman the final say over whether or not the weapons are sold.
So, as far as I understand, though, here's what I don't quite get. So, So it's not all of the, I can't remember what, it's like the munitions list.
Mm-hmm.
It's not everything that's all arms are being moved to commerce in terms of trade. It's like consumer arms, which is just gives me chills up the spine.
Which is still, according to American parlance, like assault rifles, shotguns, weapon attachments, like things that could really make a difference in the bush, or, you know, any kind of irregular warfare.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it has, like, combat shotguns. I'm looking at the list here. But it's not like, I mean, I have a big... So, spacecraft is not... That would still be part of, as far as I understand, the state. Military electronics... Ground vehicles, that's still under state. But if he's just...
It doesn't really matter.
But, like, but I'm wondering then if they're going to kind of go further with this. Because, like, if he's dumping even a notion of wanting to be part of this treaty, you know, which you're saying is meaningless, and I agree, but is it signaling further shenanigans?
Yes, I think. Like, he also, in that speech, tried to frame it in such a way as to portray it as, like, oh, we're trying to keep your freedom to possess weapons as, you know, a Second Amendment argument, but really it's difficult to see it in that kind of light, because nothing in... We produce almost all of these weapons, so there's nothing... It would be difficult to say that you can't import them, you know? You could probably buy it here already, anything that you would want.
Oh, that's their argument. He's making an import argument.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't even thought about that. That's so stupid. It's all about exporting.
Yeah, all about export.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a terrible... maybe the worst thing he's done yet. Well, the worst bureaucratic thing he's done yet.
Yeah, it's like... Trying to figure out the worst thing Trump did. It's like one of those unanswerable questions, like, which is your favorite child American. Or something like that.
Well, he killed a small American girl in, like, the first couple of weeks of his presidency, so he set the bar pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah. But that, no. See, like, this is, like, the bullshit they've always had since the beginning, because they were like, oh, that that mission was already scheduled before he became president.
That's bullshit.
So they schedule drone attacks and bombings weeks in advance and then never reassess it.
Like that. Well, it was a huge operation. They had, like, UAE gunships in support and, like, special forces on the ground. They would have had to train for weeks. That mission probably would have was scheduled at least 2 months before it was conducted.
Yeah, but there's no, like... I mean, it's... There is, of course, like, information gathering and changes to the plan, and there's still probably, I would assume, some sort of final okay.
Yeah, and that's what they were
shortly
doing
before it.
The briefing.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, come and see national security by the buffet.
Well, I imagine becoming president, you know, like, that first time, I think that'd be the time you'd ask the most questions.
Right.
Or just first few times, you know.
Except for him, in this case, he was probably like, well, make sure you shoot as many people as possible. The rules of engagement are there are no rules.
Yeah.
Like, if anybody had just given stringent rules of engagement on that operation, I don't think it would have... Okay, so one thing that I've always hated about these special operations, right, and I'm sorry to go off on this tangent, but looking at that operation, they attacked in the dead of night. A small irregular force attacks and then gets supported with helicopters. And so the people in the village, it wasn't clear who they were fighting, so they were just shooting at the attackers. And then it turns into a giant firefight. But the gunships never should have fired directly at civilian or buildings that had any civilian use.
Yeah.
Like, that should have been in the rules of engagement. There's no reason that 9-year-old little girl should have died that night.
Yeah. You know, I have a feeling this episode's going to have some tangents, so that's okay.
But to get back to our original point, can you continue it further? I just want to point out how feckless Mike Pompeo is in this role.
Go ahead.
As Secretary of State, he should be kicking and screaming and going on in front of every camera and cell phone that will turn on for him about how the president and wider government is trying to take something out of his backyard. Like, one of the most vital rules that the State Department fulfills is now being conducted by somebody else. Like, yeah. He's just...
Yeah.
Rolling over. Like a good little, laptop.
Well, I mean, that's a, you know, I'm sure there are instances underneath other administrations where there is a lack of the person running a sort of institution within a broader institution defending their organization. But because of the chaos and disorder and just, honestly, Trump's a bad boss. He's like a bad boss. Like that's half of what the Mueller report told us, was that he's really awful at just being president.
Get me on this. The reason this is so terrible and why Pompeo is such a terrible Secretary of State is because part of the Foreign Service exam to become a Foreign Service officer to work for the Department of State is the ability to argue. You have to, in a small group, present a program and argue why everyone should support it, or, you know, why funding shouldn't be cut to something that you're in support of.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be good at that skill.
Yeah.
And as head of that department, he is outright terrible at it.
Yeah, but he's good at yelling about Hillary Clinton.
Oh, and lying through his teeth about military options in Venezuela. Like, why would you make that threat? Probably in coordination. Yeah, I can probably say that. In coordination with Guaido, he issued the not-so-loaded statement, or not-so, you know, opaque statement that the U.S. will use military options if necessary against the regime in Venezuela, against Maduro, in support of the ongoing coup.
I don't know.
But it's an empty threat. It reveals how little sway that he has within the administration, because nobody serious is going to carry through. He's a Secretary of State, has no say in any military force, so he's, like, literally writing a check that he couldn't cash. it's even worse than a memorandum of understanding and less binding.
You know, it seems like it's the nature of the office in relation to this president. That, I mean, because even just look at kind of, you know, what we're talking about with this arms control, there just seems to be a now, you know, White House-wide problem of, and coming from the president, of just not respect. I mean, one of our earliest episodes is about the dismantling of the State Department and diplomatic corps, lack of ambassadors, all of that. And it just seems to be just not a priority. And so, because it seemed like he made Pompeo Secretary of State because he liked Pompeo. That was the impression I think we had. I mean, from his time as CIA director. Because remember, he was using Pompeo as a sort of unofficial Secretary of State to go to North Korea and stuff like that.
I think he used Pompeo because Pompeo was willing to be used. Like, few other Foreign Service professionals would have done what he did.
Well, and that's the thing about someone like Trump, is him liking someone doesn't mean he respects someone. It's actually probably an inverse relationship there.
Yeah, that's probably true.
He likes you because you are not worthy of respect. If you are worthy of respect, he feels intimidated by you and antagonistic towards you. Except for, like, the occasional father figure billionaire, like Rupert Murdoch, supposedly. He's a little bit in awe of Rupert Murdoch, personally. But unless you're someone like that, and so he may, you know, and this makes sense for, like, the kind of strongman dictator, right? You want to put, subordinates and or supplicants into subordinate positions and make sure that they do everything you say. Even someone like Kirstjen Nielsen, who is, like, you know, awful, just absolutely awful, was a little bit too mouthy for Trump. Had a little bit too much devotion to law.
Was unwilling to just completely go along with it.
I mean, that's psychotic.
Yeah, it really is.
Like, and they're not even trying to make the defense. They're not trying to walk it back with the kids in cages. They were very open about, like, we want more kids in cages. She's standing in the way. That's why she's out of here. It's like they didn't even hide it. And, and I think doing this, like, what otherwise might be unnoticed, mundane shifting of these arm control regulations, but then going to the NRA, announcing this big thing that isn't big, as you pointed out, but making a big show of it and signaling it and to that audience there is kind of sort of another example of this. It's just, I'm not just trying to secretly make it easier for a few arms companies to sell a few more guns around the world. I'm trying to, like, create this, I'm going a little off the deep end, but, like, this evil, bloodthirsty culture. Like, I mean, all for political gain. And that, and they're just, like, so open about it, and it works for them.
I mean, he's still in power.
It's not just that. I think he feels intimidated and afraid at times of some of these threats to his presidency and maybe long-term ability to not go to jail, but I wouldn't say he's on the ropes.
Not even.
I mean,
well, he's got Mitch McConnell serving as his linebacker, or I guess offensive guard in the Senate.
Yeah. And just enough support in the media, just enough support in the polls. It's always just enough. It doesn't really seem to be dipping below just enough.
Right.
Across the board.
He was elected by just enough.
Just enough. And so, and, you know, and, like, what the money, I don't, I listen to the 538 podcast, and they talk about the betting markets sometimes for, like, political races. And I can't remember the specifics, but I believe he's not, like, a long shot to win re-election.
No.
Like, at all. And he might even be, I don't know about favorite, but close to, you know.
I give it a 50-50 chance at this point.
You know, I felt a little, I remember before the 2018 Wisconsin gubernatorial election, we were talking about kind of chances of Scott Walker winning re-election, and I was like, I feel really uneasy, I think it's close to 50-50, and I was right. I'm not pointing that out to say I'm right, but you kind of have to take your hopes out of it and just say it. Like, he won the presidency last time, and not much has changed, ergo, he's still the favorite.
Right, like, you don't need to overthink it. These fascists are bolder now than they were then.
Yeah.
They realize that there is no real resistance, and the people that are resisting aren't, one, organized, or two, widely geographically dispersed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that...
Which is why there's two different qualifications. Like, you get Antifa in certain pockets, but they're not everywhere. And you have sort of resistance, but it's not really organized, and that seems to be everywhere. And not accomplishing very much.
Excuse me. Yeah, How do we tie back to our topic from Trump's potential for re-election? Oh, how about this? What crazy shit will he do if he's re-elected? Along these arms control, like what would, how do I put this? What would Putin do? What is Putin doing? How do they do things differently? Or if not Putin specifically, but like, what's kind of like a worst case scenario with this sort of lack of arms control? How would it look worse?
They'd start transferring weapons to people like the Nigerian army, or again, wider formations in the Cameroonian army, or you can take your pick and throw a dart at my giant map of the world and find somebody who's abusing human rights in some way, especially if they're, and if, well, I mean, look at our history. If they're being sponsored by the United States, they're probably abusing human rights in some respect. Europe, asterisk. With the slight exception of Europe.
Sure. There's a... I mean, that's a pretty broad statement there.
It is, but to be fair, like, look at the governments that we sponsor in Central and South America are genuinely terrible. Yeah. The governments we sponsor in Africa, it doesn't matter if you're democratically elected. If anything, it's probably better that you aren't. Like Idris Elba, or not Idris Elba, I'm sorry. Oh my God.
Idi Amin?
No, not Idi Amin. I'm the dictator of Chad.
Oh, yeah, you're... I don't know that one. That's a little...
Oh, I've seen Amari.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, but, okay. I mean, the only reason I hesitated a little bit at that statement is just because, you know, in some of these conflicts, I think less so in Latin America, as far as I know, but... certainly in Africa, in some of these conflicts, you know, if you're backing anyone, you're maybe backing a human rights abuser. No, I shouldn't say anyone, but anyone who's fighting.
Oh, Idris Debe. That's why. But, and, I mean, sometimes you just, the best and most moral option is to not get involved.
Yeah.
Provide medical care. Yeah. Maybe even provide peacekeeping forces so that best and most professional military in the world is there to keep everybody safe on a level.
What the hell happened to peacekeeping?
It went out with George Bush, and despite our success in Eastern Europe in stabilizing Bosnia and Herzegovina, I mean, sure, it's not perfect, especially if you look at Kosovo, but, you know, it worked. There hasn't been an active ongoing war in Europe in how many years now?
You know, excuse me, that's an unsung kind of lesson of history. Like, we're at the point where we're just under 25 years. Like, I think r/askhistorians on Reddit has a 25-year rule for history. But we're right around there, and you're right. Like, there were people who committed genocide put on trial. There is
committed suicide dramatically in front of the whole world.
Yeah, and they paid for it. At least some of them. Like, they just had a general just within the past few months. He was on trial in The Hague.
Mm-hmm. It worked. The system they built worked.
Yeah, and there were, of course, you know, it's kind of like, it's like because there were maybe political timeliness at times from Clinton when it came to that sort of thing, or maybe there was overkill with bombing. It's not perfect, but that's like the, so then you make those things better. You change something.
Right. You change the parts that didn't necessarily work the best instead of just throwing out the whole formula and saying, we're going to invade a country, remove all of its civil and legal, context and expectations and wing it.
Yeah, and like that was one of the. People talk about like, oh, you know, maybe we could have never done anything in Afghanistan. Maybe Iraq has had these hundreds-year-old sectarian conflicts, and it's just like I'm not arguing that we should have gone into Iraq or Afghanistan exactly, but if you were to do it, you could have done well. Less so Iraq. Iraq is just.
But right, like, at least better.
But like...
even Afghanistan.
Yeah, but like, the fact that they didn't take any... It's like they still did the worst part. So the worst part about, even though it ended up fine, about the peacekeeping in the Balkans, is just that, you know, people died. People were bombed. Like, that is awful. That it's... Even if it's for a greater good, that's still something to be remorseful about.
They took gave the U.S. Army a black eye when that... Those three troops got captured without even firing a shot.
They took the worst part of that conflict, ignored what worked, and took what was bad.
Yep.
Like, that's... Oh, that's... Man. And yeah. We're paying for it since.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, like... We have this culture of just blood and death, even though it's a more peaceful world.
Right, the world is getting peaceful, but we are not.
It's like something about us. It's like we need an outlet for this shit. It's like because things are more peaceful, because there's less crime, they are... they want to just stir up the pot and cause some shit. Like, we were talking about that Washington State guy.
Right, he gets ahead by being vitriolic and, what's the word? A shock jock? Or not?
Yeah, he was with a shock jock.
Yeah.
There was at this God and Country event in Washington State, and I think it was The Guardian reported that this Washington State representative was, like, saying how people need to get their AR-15s, they have to prepare for a civil war, talking about killing communists and shit like this. And you made the comment that, like, if only communists were as organized as this guy thinks.
Yeah, they're not.
No. And it's like, he's winning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not bloody enough of a win.
Yeah, they're not getting enough change. Well, I think part of it is that they know that they have to recognize on some level that this is one of their moments in history, and they need to affect as much change as they possibly can before, you know, it goes the other way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And unfortunately, these people, like the Fox News model, is that they have to resort to the most vitriolic and violent language to try to distinguish themselves and their appeals.
Yeah, get just, you're just trying to get attention, get clicks.
Yep. Grandstanding. Do you think that guy has ever actually pointed his weapon at somebody and even just thought about what it would be to kill someone? He probably hasn't served in the military.
That's so fucking
Admittedly, I served during the peacekeeping days, but even then, we still have to train as, you know, with the idea, at least in the back of our heads, like, you are looking down this rifle to kill that person that you can see moving in front of you.
Yeah.
It messes you up on some level. And the people that advocate for that, without having had any even vestige of experience, are
flippantly
most evil of grandstanding assholes.
Yeah. Well, that you know, like this whole, like Trump and guns is like this. Like, he wants to be a warlord who doesn't fight wars. Yep. I don't even mean as like a president sending people. Like, he wants to urge people to violence. He wants to make sure there's more guns in the world. He wants to support gun makers. And it's not just political, like, opportunism for Trump. I don't think. I mean, maybe there's like a kind of what if of history. Like, what if Trump had been accepted into Manhattan liberal circles in the 80s and became a Democratic president someday? I mean, I don't know. Maybe
the mob already had their hooks in him before then, though.
What?
The mob already had their hooks into him by the 80s.
Oh, yeah. But I think he likes chaos. And not, you know, I think it's like both on a personal thing, but like in the world around him. He likes he probably loves those scenes in mob movies, in war movies, where there's two like buff dudes and, you know, like someone's holding a gun threatening, and, you know, like the show 24, like Jack Bauer tactics.
Yeah, because those work on a visceral level. Or, you know, they appeal to the worst instincts in people and make them think that they work.
Yeah, he's like a 13-year-old boy who, like, just, like, gets aroused by talk of violence and threats and
sitting in big trucks.
Yeah, and no, and like, because, like, even think about his, you know, I think this kind of all ties together. Like, when he went to his first overseas trip, was the one to Saudi Arabia, right? Or the Middle East. But, yeah, the glowing orb. Jesus Christ.
That's not much of the glowing orb.
That's a comic book cover right there. And the big thing, I mean, okay, remember a picture of a glowing orb, and the only thing I remember as a takeaway in terms of achievements, or what he even just said as achievements, was the arms sales, which he didn't even negotiate. That was like a thing that was already happening. But, like, he loved that. He grasped onto that. He could have grasped onto anything. Could have grasped onto Saudi Arabia being, like, an intelligence sharer with the United States about terrorism. He could have grasped onto, I don't know.
Project 2030 in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He could have grasped onto, he could have even played up MBS as, like, a, I mean, it's a lie, but that doesn't stop him.
You know, a good negotiating partner and, like, partner in the region.
It's just, but all, he just wanted to talk about this $110 billion arms sale and how it's bringing jobs. And, like, I don't know. There's a lot of ways to have jobs.
Like, we could have people plant trees or pick up plastic and process it for recycling, or, I don't know. Can do climate alleviation geoforming.
I mean, even if we think about the types of jobs he mostly talks about, they are somehow destructive or violent.
Yeah. Well, manufacturing is kind of destructive.
Manufacturing, though, like, I don't know, does he... He talks about bringing manufacturing jobs back, but that's a sector, right? You know, that's big, yeah. That's like...
And at the same time, he's, like, destroying all the regulations over it, so it will be as destructive as they can possibly make it.
That's, like, coal plants, police officers. Yeah. Like, even if you think the best of police officers, it's still a violent, chaotic line of work.
Sure. And since you brought up violent, chaotic rules of thought, did you see how he attacked the firemen's union?
the other day.
It's too much. I heard reference to it, but I didn't know why people were talking about firemen so much.
Yeah, he's called them the dew-sucking firemen's union.
Is that because, like, the leadership is refusing to, like, work with... Because, like, I saw something that said, like, their membership does seem to be mostly Trump supporters.
Are they? But at the same time, the union is, like, very against Trump.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, is that if he's kind of like, hey, you should be... And I'm not saying he's right. He's... Even if he's right, he's never right. But, I don't know, is that why he's pointing them out specifically? Because lots of unions don't support him, right? I mean, why them?
Sure. Well, I can't remember exactly what triggered it, but more importantly for the implications is that it could split his base, because those blue line people were, like, also made up that red line variant for firefighters so they could support all first responders in the same hand flourish.
Yeah.
So this could be splitting his base. I hope it does, but I'm not optimistic, but it's the first reason I've found to be hopeful and since he started talking in front of a camera. So I guess 91?
No, he started talking before that, right?
That's when I was old enough to see him on camera.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And remember him, which I guess is the first Gulf War, which really kind of started a lot of these problems. The arms transfers and, like, our feckless secretaries of state and our terrible foreign policy. Arguably, that was one of the best invasions that the United States has ever thrown.
In terms of...
accomplishing its objective with minimal casualties. Yeah. Unfortunately, then we went beyond our objectives and committed some very serious fucking war crimes, which never should have fucking happened.
In the first Iraq War? Yeah. It's not really a war. Is it, like, a war?
It was an invasion. It was at least sponsored.
What did they do then?
Well, if you remember, when the Iraqi army was trying to retreat from Kuwait...
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Sorry.
...order death situation, whereby the U.S. Air Force took out the lead and rear elements of the convoy and then carpet-bombed everything in between and killed, like, hundreds of people.
Yeah.
What was that Marine movie that was featured in heavily?
Yeah, was it Marine? It's with George Clooney. Is that the one?
Also in that movie, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you're thinking of the one with Jake Gyllenhaal, Jarhead.
Yeah, Jarhead.
Yeah.
The most recent interpretation. But yeah, that was a war crime that never should have happened. We were attacking retreating forces.
Yeah.
We can shoot back.
You know, and, like, I'm not a international... like, you obviously know more about this. But, like... To me, I can see a justification for killing them if this is, like, a prolonged war, and it's, like, it's kind of the Saving Private Ryan dilemma. Do you kill the person that you know is going to pick up a gun and try and kill you tomorrow?
No, because you can't assume somebody's intent and shoot them. There are laws against this for a reason. Yeah, I know.
I understand, and I would, if I were in the position, follow the law and the conventions and all that. Yeah. I'm just saying it's kind of like both are a crime, but it's more egregious when you can't even, like...
Defend yourself?
You weren't going to pursue the attack. They were going to go back there. So all you're doing is just, like, it's like a flip... It's a really bloody middle finger to end it.
A turkey shoot of a middle finger.
You know, it's like we're in the midst of the last season of Game of Thrones, but in the books, they talk about it, after Robert's Rebellion, it was noteworthy that Robert was not vindictive towards... He didn't like the Targaryens, but he wasn't vindictive towards the houses that supported the Targaryens.
Like, who is that, Dorne? Is that Highgarden?
Was it Highgarden? Definitely Dorne, the Crownland houses. The Lannisters were sort of waffling. You know, they didn't get into it until the end.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah, they didn't involve themselves until they could see a profits be made from it.
But you know, just like Bush could have. Yeah, it's a big what if history, but you know, like you can't. How are you supposed to have a real peace afterwards if that's how you end it.
Right?
Yeah. No, it's awful. That's awful. Forgot about that. Quarter of death.
And, yeah, well, I guess in Dick Cheney's words, he didn't invade Iraq because he didn't see very much use in that, so I guess that's another one. If that could have gone much, much worse.
Because he didn't see much use in it. But they did later. Why didn't he see much use at the time?
Well, it was Bush's choice, not Cheney's. Like, I'm absolutely sure Dick Cheney presented that option to H.W. Bush. Like, hey, we have, like, hundreds of thousands of troops here on the border, and they didn't really shoot all that ammunition we gave them, so drive north.
Huh.
And Bush, and yeah, H.W. refused. One, that wasn't our political mandate, and yeah, it would have just turned into a mess five ways from Sunday, which we saw 10 years later.
Yeah.
Or 12 years later, sorry.
So,
but even Afghanistan was clusterfuck because the Taliban offered to provide Osama bin Laden's head on a plate and cooperate with U.S. efforts to pull him out of their country.
Have you heard of... so I've heard that, but I've never heard the rationale for not taking
because
that deal.
Cheney wanted to make it... Cheney and Rumsfeld wanted to make it a military action rather than a law enforcement action. Like, they could have deployed, like, a group of Green Berets with a handful of special FBI agents with language skills to go into Afghanistan, arrest bin Laden, and extradite him to the United States. And that shit probably would have been over in a matter of months. They could have rounded up everybody who was still sitting there. But instead, we started a war that is still not ended.
So, is that just because they wanted him in a military... Well, which never happened, but in a military, because they didn't trust the civil court? Is it that argument?
No, they wanted to put all that money and energy into
not civil court
running
more.
Their military budget and, you know, the rule of the military in the United States, and they were not going to refuse that opportunity
yes.
in that crisis to, you know, yeah. Of course not, obviously.
You know, I've seen the movie Vice since we last did an episode, and I couldn't really figure out from the movie's interpretation why, like, is it he just was kind of personally greedy? I mean, he ends up in the end a lot richer than he began.
Of course,
Cheney.
Of course,
probably Rumsfeld too. But I mean, there's just so much effort put in towards subverting the political process. Isn't there easier ways to make money? There must not be.
Not that kind of money. I mean, they had, billions disappear off of pallets, so off of the back of a plane, so, yeah. He made a lot of people insanely wealthy.
Yeah. He likes making others wealthy, too. That's a good point.
I mean, that's like Tony Stark says, or is quoted in Age of Ultron, Keep your friends rich and your enemies rich, and then wait to see which is which.
Well, let's get back to this arms thing before we finish up. I just had an idea. Tell me what you think about it. Because I'm trying to think of how is this. So let's say kind of what we're talking about. It has some sort of big, New York Times or fucking Rachel Maddow expose or something. And this becomes something that, let's say, presidential candidates talk about. And there's the obvious, as we've discussed, kind of intrinsic value to limiting arms towards conflict zones. But I am highly skeptical that Americans give a shit about that. Even ones that do give a shit about it, I just don't think it's a high priority. It's kind of like on both sides. That's a tangent we can get to in a second. But so I was thinking, is there kind of a domestic angle to this? Because arms manufacturers are
becoming decent political boogeymen. They are becoming, because they are, you know, villains, bad guys. And so is there, you know, with the mass shootings happening, and you know, there is some sort of groundswell for doing something about guns. You know, it's always vague. There are some cool things out there that we've discussed actually on the show, I believe, in the past. But like, is this sort of like a, is there a political avenue towards kind of using this as a proxy for a domestic priority?
Well, that's that political flourish. There is a practical effect in that this will open up markets for those weapon manufacturers that had been previously behind regulations and, like, the State Department.
Yeah.
So now that those markets are opened up, there will be at least some economic effect. And for the political flourish, he got to stand in front of the NRA and unsign something like he enjoys doing. Tearing something apart and making all those Second Amendment advocates or fanatics feel as though they got a genuine victory by something that he unsigned, even though it, again, had very little practical effect on anything that they had anything to do with. Like, cause I'm pretty sure none of those people own any part of the arms manufacturing infrastructure, the military-industrial complex.
Wait, what people?
The people in Florida, or I guess that was probably Green Bay, that were cheering that announcement.
Well, I mean, probably not in Green Bay, but in terms of the NRA stuff, I mean, there's... I guess I don't know who goes to NRA annual meetings, if it's just like rank and file.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. The rank and file, other than stock purchases, is not benefiting from this in any way.
Sure, except for
some of that feel-good way.
But this is a way that those arms manufacturers can make more money. Mm-hmm. And they are the primary, you know, the NRA doesn't support itself by, you know, membership donations as much as it does from big, you know, financing from gun manufacturers.
Yeah.
And you know, and then they are rewarded for that investment through lobbying and PR efforts by the NRA. And so, I mean, to me, it's like, this is kind of the Trump, you know, the government, opening new sources of funding for... I'm not saying it's necessarily like quid pro quo for the NRA, like this is some sort of written down contract or even a direct causation, but I mean, that seems to be an effect of it.
I mean, I'm not sure how much new funding this is opening. This is like payback for investments that people have already made in Trump becoming president in 2016.
Well, there's always more elections, though. There's always more. An organization like the NRA is not giving up on trying to get their benefactors richer.
No, certainly not.
Let's end with... so I actually had this thought recently about bringing up Americans not giving a shit about foreign policy. To me, it just seems to be true. Like, there does not seem to be... Every election, like, let's look at... I mean, it almost never comes up in congressional elections, unless you're, like, in the middle of a war or something. You know, like, how many people running for Congress in 2018 were asked much in the way of substantive questions about anything to do with anything outside of our borders? You know,
Very few.
Just doesn't happen.
And probably fewer had the wherewithal to answer them.
Yeah, yeah, yes. The questions were wishy-washy, and the answers were even more wishy-washy. So it does, and so then I think to presidential elections, and it doesn't seem like, to my knowledge of election history, that foreign policy has played a major role. maybe 60, Nixon, Kennedy, maybe 80, Carter, Reagan. Like, we can disagree with how the electorate decided, but, you know, or ended up. But it being a major deal, like, Clinton wasn't elected on...
2008?
Yeah, okay, so, yeah, so I was thinking about that. 2008, I think there's a good argument for 2008.
I mean, Obama probably did limit the war on terror far more than John McCain would have.
Well, although so...
John McCain probably wouldn't have been as innovative as Obama was in his war crimes.
So there was definitely a... so both in the primary between Hillary and Obama... And then that kind of transferred over into the general, McCain-Obama, on, you know, Obama's like, I didn't vote for Iraq, because I wasn't there, and I wouldn't have voted for Iraq, for the war in Iraq. And the electorate hates the war in Iraq, ergo, I should win. And, yeah, I mean, I guess that was a pretty important part of that. It's just that financial crisis, like, hitting that summer and fall... maybe muddied the waters on that, determining what was the big issue, but even so, it wasn't as much about a vision. It was like about a vision of what we should do in that one situation.
Mm.
It didn't really speak to, you know, there was kind of the wishy-washy, like hope and change, and, you know,
sure.
Give speeches in Berlin and win Nobel Prizes.
Or hope and change, that's what distinguished him from Hillary.
Yeah. I feel as if, though, he was more... Not that he was ever super specific about policy, but he was less specific about international policy. But I guess that doesn't mean that that's not what people were voting on. So, anyway, and I'm leading to... we can point to... Maybe Cold War for 60 and 80 and Iraq War for 2008 as being very important foreign policy presidential elections.
Vietnam War. 72? Or is that 68?
68, but... I don't even know how people voted based on it. It was like a big deal, especially in the primary, the Democratic primary.
Yeah, just like in 2008.
But what was... Did people vote for Nixon because
he was going to end the war.
And the person who had the nomination was LBJ's VP, if I recall.
Yeah.
But see, they were actually trying to end the war. Nixon was trying to extend it. But that was a secret, so I guess you're right.
Okay, so that's the thing. Nixon was the pro-war candidate.
No, I'm saying... I think he did say something. I think he was along the McCain line of, like, I'm going to bomb the shit out of them to end the war. That's the only way to end it. And the, is it Humphrey? I think it's Humphrey. Yeah, because McGovern was 72. Humphrey, LBJ's VP, was in negotiations with South Vietnam. Sorry, he wanted to... have negotiations with North Vietnam to end the conflict. And they were trying to get that done before LBJ left office. Humphrey was trying to benefit from LBJ having those negotiations to end the war. But...
What a different world it would have been if they had accomplished that before the election.
But this is so much fucking like, by the... God damn it, I hate Nixon and Trump. The connections we do. But Nixon, this just came out within the past few years... Nixon had a back channel to South Vietnam, to some of the hardliners there, to not accept any deal, thereby extending the war. Now, Nixon may have, like, said, because I want to get the credit for ending it when I'm president, but nothing he did, you know, would exactly show that he even cared about ending it. Until it was ended, under him, I guess, in 74, right?
Yeah.
No, he was out. Well, it's right around the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I guess that was kind of a big deal in that election, but that one's really fucked up. So I don't know that this change to 22 CFR is going to, you know, be the same deal as a war, obviously. But is there, as long as Trump doesn't get into a war, is there a foreign policy argument that is that has any chance of being effective?
No. A lot of the military actions, like, for instance, he's expanded the war in Somalia, but we barely hear about it because it's all behind a wall of classification and geography and language. So
can like senators on the Armed Forces Committee or Intelligence Committee make a stink about that stuff more? Or are they bound by classification?
They could. I mean, Mike Gravel was notionally bound by classification, but still read the Pentagon Papers out loud.
Yeah, but the Pentagon Papers had been... I mean, I kind of agree with...
I mean, I just mean to use that example to say that there are ways that they can make issues known to the public around classification concerns.
Yeah.
Or through them.
Well, let's even kind of use, though, the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers were leaked independent of Gravel, and then after they were leaked, and that was being dealt with by the papers, and then he read it into the record, thereby cementing its place in the public knowledge, right? I think that's how that went down.
Public record.
So either more shit needs to be leaked to the presses about stuff like Somalia, or... you know, to get around that classification, or they have to figure out ways to reveal things that can get attention that aren't classified, I guess.
And that's like embedding reporters into war zones.
Which they can't do, right?
I mean, I can't think of too many newsroom editors that would willingly place their reporters into those situations.
Well, even beyond that, but isn't the U.S. military not really working with... they're trying to not have press coverage of it. So, right. Like, if you tried to be like, hey, could I be embedded with the Rangers and operating out of Mogadishu or something? They would be like, no, you can't.
Absolutely no fucking way.
So you have to, like... So then the security duty falls to the papers or the media outlet, and that's... They don't want to set... That's too risky.
Right, they couldn't even afford the insurance.
Yeah. All right. So, I think that's a good place to stop. Because a little description of where these guns are going.
Right.
To these secret, violent campaigns. Actually, do you remember... Let's just point people to... What was that... article about the war zones in Africa. Or not the war zones, but where the U.S. is operating.
Terce's series about Africa.
Who was that again?
Nick Terce?
Yeah. That's The Intercept, right?
I think so. Yeah. Look it up. We could probably post it with the...
but I think that's it. Yeah, it is. His reporting, and particularly... came out in the past few weeks, I think kind of ties in this, the wars, the foreign policy, the secrecy, the tie, you know, the relationships with gun manufacturers, NRA, you know, it's not necessarily all like a conscious conspiracy, but I would call it collusion.
Like an unspoken conspiracy or collusion.
It's just interests align, right? Isn't that?
Yep. The same interests. They're all working in the same way, so they would do it independently of each other. And if they talk about it, even just a little, it just, you know, greases the wheels.
Yeah. And it's the same the lack of reservations about the same, like, human rights and ethics concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So this has been Tell Me What to Think. Check me out on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. Charles is at green_weird, which is spelled W-Y-R-D. TMWTTPOD@gmail.com is our email to contact us. We have a Facebook page, Tell Me What to Think. You can go ahead and Tell Me What to Think or stoneduckmedia.com to see the archives and new episodes. And, yeah, I think that's it. You have a good week, Charles.
You too. Thank you to all of our listeners out there.
For sure. Oh, and check out Jacob Green if you're in the Vermont area or when his album comes out soon. All right, later.
Later.
Goal of peace. Some days it's sunny, some days it rains. Destroy the myth and we'll break our chains. Break your chains.